Welcome, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, a podcast about existentialism and forever night. Forever Night was episodic, but this podcast kind of isn't. You may be best served starting at the beginning with the introduction and working your way forward. So with that, let's begin. Good evening, gentle listener. Tonight's installment of Still Dreaming looks at episode 6 of Forever Night, entitled Dying to Know You. This episode originally aired on the 9th of June, 1992, and was directed by Brad Turner and written by Tony Shearer. The synopsis, plundered from Wikipedia, reads as such. A psychic helps Nick and Skanky locate a kidnapped wife and daughter, but her gifts also give her a troubling peek into Nick's centuries-old past, including an encounter in Puritan-era America with another mild psychic. So, I feel like maybe I should elaborate a little more on what this episode is about, what's going on. I'm still going to give a rundown of the scenes like I usually do, but I think maybe a big picture approach might be helpful with this one. This episode is a little different. There's the mystery of the week, which frankly isn't much of a mystery. There's the main guest star, the psychic, and there's flashbacks. But while some of the flashbacks are in Nick's mind, most of them are the psychic having insights into Nick's past. That almost makes this a clip show, since a lot of the memories the psychic has are short segments from previous episodes. I don't know if this was a budget-saving measure or if it was genuinely just a creative choice, but I found it interesting either way. In case you're wondering, yes, the psychic is real in the universe of the show. She's not pulling a scam. She's a genuine clairvoyant. And the only character that seems to question this is Skanky. Everyone else is on board with it. Which is just a little weird to me. The mystery isn't very mysterious, as I'll explain. It's a little bit dark at the ending, but not really surprising. It was difficult for me to determine what the theme of the episode was, but since memory and identity are sort of mildly indicated, I'm going to use that as my jumping-off point for this one. So, Henri Bergson lived from 1859 to 1941, and wrote one of the texts I'll be referencing tonight, Matter and Memory, in 1896. Now, Bergson isn't an existentialist. He belongs to continental philosophy and French spiritualism, but he is a significant influence on both the phenomenologists, like Merleau-Ponty, and on Jean-Paul Sartre. Sartre actually cites Bergson directly in his work Being and Nothingness, which I'll also be drawing on from this week. So tonight I'm looking at the nature of memory and what it means to being and freedom and choice, or, you know, something kind of like that. If you're interested, and I can't imagine that you would be, the 1910 English translation of Matter and Memory is available for free in its entirety from Google Books. This is obviously the version I'm using. And to be complete about it, I'm using the standard Barnes translation of Sartre. So with that, let's jump in. We begin the episode on a sunny day in Toronto. A limo is parked on the street and a driver drops off some ladies in a downtown shopping district. The driver, now alone in the car, talks to himself about how the women are going to spend a lot of money, because women be shopping, right? So This is something I've been thinking about as I watch this series. While generally, I think relying on tired cliches, like women loving to shop or whatever, is lazy storytelling. But when it comes to these episodic TV shows, where you got 47 minutes at most to tell an entire encapsulated story, introduce new characters, develop a plot, give your main characters something to do and possibly some character growth, solve a mystery, and then reset the characters for the next week, all structured within predetermined chunks that fit in between commercial breaks, like, how do you not rely on cliches? Anyway, the driver is waiting in the car when he's approached by somebody dressed very much like him and is attacked. But not like with a gun or a knife, with a syringe in the neck. Ugh. So we cut to a nice apartment where a woman is finishing her exercises. She's not apparently related to anything happening at the limo. We quickly cut back to the car. The women have returned shopping bags in hand. At the apartment, the woman is now in the bathtub, while the imposter driver at the limo takes the women on a drive out of town. The women in the car suddenly realize they've been kidnapped. The woman in the apartment seems perturbed. As the limo pulls up into a gravel lot and then into a garage, and obviously this is bad news. The woman in the apartment is then on the phone with our Chief Stonetree, telling him there's been a kidnapping. She apparently just has his phone number. This woman is the psychic mentioned in the synopsis. We'll find out later her name is Denise. That brings us to the opening credits. When we come back from the credits, our detectives are in the garage where the women were taken to. It's night shift, and Nick is there. Skanky comes in, saying that the chief called in half the day shift, too. Chief Stonetree is there and mentioned that the kidnapped women were Conrad Hedges' wife and daughter. The detectives immediately know who that is, and the audience finds out that Hedges is a very wealthy philanthropist with friends in high places, lots of political weight. The psychic, Denise, is also at the crime scene, and at first the detectives don't know who she is, and they're wondering who the hell this chick is and how she knows that the kidnappers put the women in a brown van. The captain has a lot of faith from her right from the outset. Remember, she apparently just called him directly. Mr. Hedges is there. I would imagine he'd be a suspect. Why is he at the crime scene? Anyway, Hedges is there, and he seems a little concerned that the chief is bringing in a psychic at the beginning of the investigation. I mean, he's right. The captain orders most of the cops to clear out so Denise can do her thing, and well, that doesn't inspire much confidence either. Side note, Captain Stonetree is the chief for Knight and Skanky, and in the pilot, I really didn't gel with him. He had such a strange delivery to his lines that I just did not get. But in the episode since then, he's kind of grown on me. I think he's still bonkers for just letting this chick walk all over a crime scene, though. So Skanky is going on and on about how he doesn't like psychics, while Denise does her thing. She's sitting in the limo, and she begins to have visions of the driver's death. She starts picking up on Nick's past, also. She also senses the murdered chauffeur is nearby, which he is. Nick finds the body in the place where she indicates. We cut to Natalie's lab, and Nat is talking to Denise. Nick comes into the lab, and Denise is distracted. She touches the dead body of the driver to get her visions, and everyone's just okay with this. I mean, Natalie is just okay with this. Now, I get this is a universe with vampires, so I shouldn't be surprised that clairvoyants are also real in this universe. But I guess I just wanted a little more pushback from Natalie. You're just gonna let this strange woman run her hands on this body? Or maybe a little bit of dubiousness from the captain? You're just gonna let this strange woman tromp all over a crime scene? but only Skanky questions her. Anyway, as Denise is getting a narrative on the driver's death, she gets what I'll call interference from Nick. She starts seeing his past and gets freaked out. Nick is able to sort of pull her back into the investigation. She sees basically what we just saw in the opening, but she flips out as she sees more images of Nick's vampirism. So, is Denise with the police? Because it kind of seems like she is. She will have free range in the crime scenes, in the victim's home. Detectives are assigned to work with her. She's in the lab with a dead body talking to Natalie. Now, Stonetree says she's done work with them before and has provided good results. And we, the audience, can see that she is, in fact, the real thing. But, like, I just, like, what is her job? What does she do for a living? She doesn't have a badge that we see. Is she on the books as a police consultant? Does she work for the city? Like, I really want to know more about her official position within the department. Anyway, her little freak out takes us to commercial. Back from the break in the captain's office, the commissioner's on the phone breathing down his neck. This Hedges guy runs an international charitable organization called Human Touch and seems to be very wealthy, very powerful, and very well connected. Skanky is in the office reporting in. Hedges seems clean, but the captain tells him to dig deeper. Just then Hedges himself walks in. No announcement or getting past reception or anything like that. He just strolls right into a police captain's office like he owns the place. So yeah, rich guy. He says he got a ransom demand, $1 million in small denominations. The captain pushes to have Denise and Knight go to Hedges' house to get a feel for where the women might be held. Hedges says he thinks the psychic is a waste of time, but the chief persists. Then we cut to Nick, driving around in his caddy under a full moon. Flashback time. We're in Puritan America. Oh, sorry, I should be more specific. 17th century Puritan America. Nick is in a stable with a cute little bob haircut. A man comes in, and his name is Matthew. He thinks he's seen a demon. Matthew, we will find out, has seen or has had psychic visions of Nick as a vampire flying in the night sky. Matthew fears he's either possessed or going mad. Nick seems cold, but not necessarily cruel. He assures Matthew that what he thinks he's seen were just tricks of the light. Back in present time, Nick picks up Denise. She explains that sometimes she's overwhelmed with information and she gets confused. She's not taking her visions of Nick and vampires as being literally true, although that seems to be how her powers work. Nick plays concerned, and here's where I get a little bit lost in the universe they're trying to establish. Vampires are real. Check. Psychics are real. Check. It seems that once people are shown that such things are real, they accept them as such. Natalie accepts Nick as a vampire. Now, at this point in the series, we have not been shown or told how she found this out or what her reaction was to it. Everyone just accepts Denise is really a psychic, except maybe Skanky. And she is one, so fine. But Denise, the psychic, who so fully trusts her powers that she calls a police chief out of the blue to inform him of a kidnapping that she's only gotten a brief flash of while in the bathtub, has clear visions of Nick being violent and killing, but she doesn't trust those? I don't know. It just seems like either Denise should be less doubting of her own powers and start thinking Nick has is a secret serial killer, or that others should be a lot more dubious about psychics being real. I guess I'm looking for a little more consistency on the credulity level of the average person in this universe. Anyway, Denise asks, "Detective Knight, do you believe in past lives?" He doesn't answer. At the estate, they talk about Hedges. She emphasizes his good works and philanthropy. She actually did mission work for him. That's the term they use. So, is Human Touch a religious organization, or does mission work mean something else? Skanky did mention that there was a picture of Hedges with Mother Teresa, but there are really no indications of religious affiliation. I suppose it's irrelevant. But he is super rich, and the one scene we have of his wife and daughter are them acting like consumerist-obsessed rich folks, and even now they're going into his expansive mansion. So I'm just saying I have my reservations about how much of a good guy he really is. They have a suitcase of $500,000 in the house. That's all Conrad could get his hands on in short notice, he said. He and Nick talk about the plans while Denise hears things. She hears with her powers an argument with Conrad and his wife and daughter, so clearly not all was well. Nick and her go upstairs and Nick has a reflection in the mirror. Okay, cool. Mythos stuff. Vampires have reflections. But Denise sees him all vamped out with the eyes and the teeth in the reflection. She flips out and she can't explain it, but she sort of waves it off, not telling Nick what she saw. They split up and search the house. It's sort of beige-dominated tones, mass-produced art, 90s decor. Looks a little bit like a hotel. We hear more voices, more fighting and threats between Conrad and his wife. This is intercut with Nick's flashbacks. Kind of cool idea. It's Denise having Nick's flashbacks this week, not Nick. There are scenes from the Puritan era we were introduced to earlier, and then actually scenes from previous episodes. She flips out and suggests leaving the case. She can't make sense of what she's seen. But she's pulled into the daughter's room. There's something significant there, she thinks, but interference from Nick, and she makes a run for it. Nick chases after her and gets her calm again. The phone rings in the house. Nick confronts Denise. She admits she's seeing visions of him in different times with blood on his face. Ask him what it means. But the phone calls for Nick, and it's Skanky. The wife's body has been found. She's had her neck cut. And that revelation takes us to commercial break. So let's pause at this point to consider a few things about the nature of memory. Henri Bergson developed his notion of pure memory as an image remembrance, which is contemplative and spiritual. For Bergson, the split between body and spirit is not Cartesian, it's temporal. The spirit is the locus of the past, whereas the body exists in the present. To take consciousness or be aware of anything is to look at it in light of the past. Sartre has a similar notion, taken and developed in part from Bergson. Sartre will say that while we all have, quote unquote, a past, the use of the possessive is inadequate to describe our relationship with it. Using the possessive indicates an external relationship with something. More accurate, says Sartre, to say, I am my past, as the present is the foundation of my past. To say, I am, presupposes and supports the continuance of my past. Bergson will use the analogy of focusing a camera to describe how, when one recollects a memory, one detaches oneself from the present to replace oneself in the past. The present is but an instantaneous moment, the collision of future and past in the indivisible moment of presence. It is the instant now that becomes no longer now. When one speaks of their present condition, they speak not of a singular instant, but of a duration. So far, in these first six episodes of Forever Night, we've seen Nick continuously defined through and against his past. And because TV is a visual medium, this is represented through visual memories. We see Nick lost in memory, chained to memory, struggling to find his identity either within or against his memories of himself. Sometimes even blind and deaf to the present unfolding around him, because he becomes lost in reflections of his past. But what does that mean, really? What is the relationship between self, time, and memory? What does it mean to have a past? What does it mean to be lost there? Bergson describes two extremes of personality, the man of impulse and the dreamer. The man of impulse lives in the fragmentary moment of now, reacting to stimulus, not reflecting or contextualizing action through recollection. More animal, living on instinct. On the other end of the spectrum is the dreamer, who lives only in the past, lost in constant reflection. Nick is further down the dreamer end, though we've certainly seen him be impulsive. For Sartre, the present is defined as being. But at any moment, the present disappears from the future and evaporates into the past, meaning the present is only nothingness. Thus, by the way, the title of his book, Being and Nothingness. The past is our facticity, as Sartre calls it, the unchangeable and unchoosable. The past intersects with the future at the present, and for Sartre, the present means to be present, presence, to act, to choose. But let's hold on to that for a moment and return to the episode. We're at the morgue, and Denise touches the body of the wife, but there's still too much interference from Nick. She flips out and runs off, clearly quite frightened of Nick. Nat says, "She knows about you." So it's interesting that Denise gets visions from dead bodies, suggesting that memories linger in the body, almost like a static charge. Also interesting from the point of view of Sartre, who held that death was ultimately the unity of past and present. Anytime I say how I feel, I am happy, for example, what I actually mean is I was happy, because I only know my state through reflection and thus in the past. But death is the ultimate I am. Its finality unifies us as pure facticity. Our subjectivity ends, and we become a collection of data points and numbers to be filed, recollected, or forgotten. I find it interesting that with the exception of the women being kidnapped at the beginning, we really only see Denise get flashes from dead bodies and Nick, who's technically undead. The scene takes us to one of Nick's flashbacks. Matthew prays for forgiveness. He's a psychic and he's terrified. He's afraid he's going mad. Pilgrim Nick hears his prayers. Now, this Nick is clearly not the more compassionate Nick of our time, but he's not a monster either. I like that. It suggests that there's been an evolution for him. Back in the present time, Conrad makes a TV plea to the kidnappers. He says there will be no police interference. Our heroes watch from inside the police station. The captain is upset and asks Nick if he found anything, since Denise hasn't disclosed anything. Skanky gets snippy, saying the psychic is wasting their time, and he's the only one doing police work. And frankly, in this moment, I agree with Donnie on this one. We know she's really a psychic, but she's not giving much to the cops, at least nothing of real use. And apparently this super high-profile case has only two detectives and a psychic working on it, and that's it. Nick brings up that this might not be a kidnapping, that Conrad might be scamming them. He mentions that Denise sensed conflict, which just ruffles Skanky even more. And Skanky's protest about Denise really starts to seem like it's based on jealousy. This is validated when Skanky leaves the room and goes out through reception. There's a reporter there looking for a soundbite. The reporter flatters Skanky, saying he's a rising star and a key investigator in the crime. She gets him to appear on camera, even though he and we the audience know he probably shouldn't be. He begins by ranting about the use of a psychic, claims that he found the driver's body, which is a lie. Denise pointed them to it, and Nick actually uncovered it. And because Donnie is a bad dick, he let slip the psychic part out, which the media didn't know about, and the reporter naturally jumps on it immediately. Skanky tries to backtrack, tells the reporter not to air that part, and quickly leaves. And by the way, this isn't resolved in the episode in any way. We see zero repercussions to Skanky's slip-up here. Why is it even in the episode, then? So we cut to the chief with Denise in his office, and she wants off the case. And that's actually what she says. I want off the case. So is she officially assigned to the case? Is she on payroll? Can she be called as a witness by prosecutors? So many questions. Anyway, she's cracking. She feels her sanity is threatened. She tries to walk out. She mentions Nick, but she doesn't elaborate, of course. The chief briefly seems to think maybe Nick did something inappropriate, but Denise tells him that's not the case. We cut to Nick and his caddy. There's another flashback. By the way, Pilgrim Vampire is my indie rock band name. Matthew confronts Nick. He tries to mind-whammy Matthew, but it doesn't work. For God's sake, what are you, Matthew pleads. Nick coldly responds, I'm just one of God's creatures, like you. In the lair, Nick is relating the story to Nat. She's making him a protein drink of some kind, and I do like these little touches. In almost every episode, there's some reference to Natalie's treatment of Nick, even if it's just one line or a little activity with no dialogue. Nice continuity. She tells Nick to come clean to Denise, to reassure her that she's not going crazy. Nick and Nat are flirty and close, and it's cute, and just kiss her, damn it. Oh, sorry, got a little carried away. The captain calls. You're driven Denise crazy, he accuses Nick. He also reveals that Hedges is gone, disappeared with the money. You'd think the chief might lead with that. Nick hangs up, tells Nat to call Skanky, and he runs to the window. Nat pleads with him not to go that way, but he flies out the window. At Denise's apartment, we have a flashback again. Matthew has hanged himself. Clearly, Nick is worried Denise might be capable of the same. He walks into her apartment, not knocking or anything. Denise is freaked out, as you know she should be. She's been having visions of this guy killing people, and now he just barges into her place without any notice. You're not losing your mind, he reveals to her, and he shows her his vampire side. With that dramatic reveal, we cut to commercial break. And when we come back, she accepts this in a kind of crazy way. She says it's a relief, because it means she's still sane. And honestly, I'm okay with it. It makes as much sense as anything else, and I really like the guest star in the episode. It's such a weird role. It must be difficult to play a part like that and keep it grounded. She does a really good job. I like the character, and she feels authentic. In this scene, they do a little recap on Nick's story. He's 800 years old. He doesn't kill anymore, doesn't drink human blood anymore. She asks if he can fly. He says he can. And she asks if he can take her some time. He smiles and says he'll think about it. He explains about Hedges, and they go to the estate, where Skanky is waiting. Denise says something cryptic to Donnie about his wife. He calls his wife on a big-ass early 1990s mobile phone and tries to interrogate her on the evening. He gets into an argument with his wife, and again, it's a nice little continuity with previous episodes. Good touch. Inside the house, Denise has some visions. Side note, and totally irrelevant to the plot. In this scene, we will see a chihuahua sculpture in the background. A chihuahua is a ritual object of the Bambara ethnic group of Mali. It's also really popular with middle-class and upper-class North American collectors because the designs on these objects that go really well with modernist decor. And that's not a joke, it's not a side remark. This is not an uncommon item to see in TV and movies as a signifier of sophistication and style, and of course, wealth. I could do a much further analysis on the dynamics of how African art becomes commodified signifiers of status in Western culture, but that's awfully close to what I do in my day job. Maybe a bonus episode, if anyone cares. Back to the program. Denise senses violence. The women knew a secret. At the Human Touch Foundation, Hadjis is there. At the morgue, with Nat and the wife's body, Nat's report on the body indicates that powdered milk under her fingernails was there along with skin cells, meaning she was in a fight. But the milk sounds like something that would be in a kitchen, and maybe not a rich person's kitchen, but it would be in a food bank, like what Human Touch runs. With this info revealed, Nick goes there but refuses to take Denise with him. In this episode, both Nick and Denise are beings trapped in the past. Nick is trapped in his own past, but Denise, as a psychic, is trapped in the recollections of others. She talks of sometimes being overwhelmed by the visions of other people's memories, as a conduit of the past, of really other people's trauma. We don't get a sense of her own subjectivity, which again is why I like the portrayal by the guest actress. She does an admirable job of keeping Denise relatable. Denise's condition as a psychic leads her to specific sets of action. She takes these recollections, which are not hers, as a spur to find justice and bring voice to those who have been silenced. When Denise has her visions, they come with the emotions and sensations of the original person who had them. Denise, rather dramatically, embodies the Bergsonian notion of how memory moves from static recollection to actual sensation. When we dwell on a memory, we bring it forth, in Bergson's reckoning, to the present, which is both sensation and movement. The present is bodily. Pure memory is materialized through recollection and causes sensation, whereupon it ceases to be memory and becomes the present. Through this process, Denise lives the lives of others, embodying their sensations. But then the sensations fade into the immediate past, becoming a sort of double. They are the memories of the original mind, but now also Denise's facsimile. Interesting how such a person as Denise could have any stable sense of self and memory. Perhaps that's why she felt she was going mad. She felt her powers had finally unseated her mind. Nick, on the other hand, experiences only his own memories. When Nick so reflects, he's clinging to what Sartre would term the being for itself and the what has been. What Nick struggles with is how the past shadows his future. As we've described in previous episodes, Nick is in a state of anguish, which for Sartre indicates a reflective understanding of the self in a state of freedom. Every moment Nick, like the rest of us, must choose himself. We must choose without any external validation. Nick's self, his being, is constantly running from the past while dragging it behind him like a ball and chain. He blindly careens into the future because he keeps looking at what he thinks is chasing him. He experiences anxiety about the future because he doesn't quite realize his freedom. The future, according to Sartre, is a lack. The future is not realized, it's only possibility. Nick fears continuity where there is only uncertainty. Sartre writes, quote, "I am an infinity of possibilities, for the meaning of the for itself is complex and cannot be contained in one formula," end quote. But as he also writes, possibilities exist in a hierarchy. Which is to say, while the possibilities for what I will do tomorrow are nearly infinite, the actuality is that it will most likely be a lot like what I did today. Nick is afraid of the hierarchy, of the continuity, of living in bad faith, as we've discussed in previous episodes. But while these things press on him, he doesn't quite seem to be able to turn his head around from the past and face the self-annihilation of the present, to be present, to choose, and in so doing, live life. Back at Human Touch, Hedges talks to two men who've pulled up in a car. These goons say that the daughter is alive. Hedges said they were supposed to kill her. Nick breaks into the back, as yet unnoticed. The goons taunt Hedges. They get the money from him. Hedges is embezzling, by the way, and really none of this is a surprise. The goons say the daughter knows everything about him, his betrayal, and his crimes. And then they leave it to him, Hedges, to kill her if he wants her dead. She's tied up in the trunk of the car. What the fuck? What the actual fuck kind of assassins are these? I mean, blackmail him for money. Oh, more money. Okay, sure. But what's with this weird moralizing? What's with making him do it? These goons cut the throat of the wife, were paid to do the same to the daughter, and now they're weirdly leaving the girl behind so this immensely powerful, rich, and well-connected man can concoct any old story he wants? Nothing about this scene makes sense. You think Hedges could afford better hired guns. So, magically, Denise is there. Like, magically, right there, right next to Hedges. She confronts, with righteous indignation, the man that she knows is a killer, and who even now is pointing a gun at his own daughter. For fuck's sake, Denise, you're kind of stupid. So Nick has to literally fly in to save her dumb ass. He knocked out the goons in one blow. Hedges shoots Denise. Vampire Nick throws aside Hedges, checks in on the daughter, and then checks on Denise. And then suddenly he's flying with Denise. So, where are you going? Is he flying her to a hospital? Does he realize she's dying? Because guess what? She dies. So I guess that loose end of her knowing he's a vampire isn't going to be a problem. We cut to commercial break. When we come back, Nat and Nick are at his lair and they're sad about Denise because, you know, she's dead. You couldn't have saved her, Nat says. Okay, so what actually happened? If Nick was giving her a flight because she wanted one and then she died, or if he was taking her to a hospital but she died, where did he put her body? Did he take it back to the crime scene? Did he hide it? I'm confused. Nick's upset because he revealed his true identity to her to save her sanity, but her renewed confidence led to her following him to the warehouse where she was killed, so he feels guilty. This is in contrast to Pilgrim Matthew, who Nick lied to about his true nature, and then Matthew killed himself thinking that he was going insane. So Nick is feeling like he's a sower of chaos and death. This sad revelation brings us to sunset over Toronto and wait, what's happening? Why is this music playing? Is this what? Oh my God, is this really happening? Oh my God, it is. Holy shit, guys, we're getting a music video. So, guys, we get a full-on music video montage of Moody Nick in a dark lair throwing a ball against a wall, looking all sad and forlorn. There's an inexplicable motorcycle in the lair that, as far as I know, has never been there before. Voiceovers, replay lines from that episode. He plays chess with himself. No, seriously, he lounges on the floor, looking all anguished, moving chess pieces around a tiny chessboard until lightning flashes outside. His shirt is all unbuttoned halfway down his chest, and he looks up at the camera in an overhead shot. The song is called "The Night Calls My Name," and it cuts to Nick and his caddy. "The Night Calls My Name." The music is great, and by great, I mean it perfectly suits the cheese of this montage. It beautifully encapsulates late 80s, early 90s pop rock, and I will totally post a link to the video with the entire song on the Facebook group. This took my breath away. It was so sudden, so unexpected, so out of fucking nowhere. And then it just ends. Just as the future evaporates into the past, as it becomes nothing, it just ends. And then suddenly we're back at the police station for wrap-up time. In dialogue that's kind of dumb and feels like it was written in 30 seconds, we confirm that Hadge is skimming for years and that the wife and daughter found out. So we already knew that. It's unnecessary. Nat and Nick come in with carry-out dinner. There's a line that the only dirty player at Human Touch was Hedges, so the foundation might still be saved. Wait, what? I'm not sure how that works. It's apparently such a massive international organization, it really seems unlikely that one man could steal so much money and go entirely undetected by any accountants or lawyers that such an organization would certainly have. But anyway, it's wrap-up time. There's a joke about tofu burgers. The episode ends with a laugh at Skanky's expense. And that's it. The end. Okay, the only thing I can think about right now is that song, The Night Calls My Name. Brooding Nick and a motorcycle. There is at least one music video with the song on YouTube using scenes from Forever Night, and I will definitely post that online. Seriously, what the hell was that? Did the show come in short on time? Did they just need padding? Was it to showcase the music and sell the soundtrack? Because guess what, folks? It worked. I got that song on my Spotify favorites list right now. As awesome as it was, if they just needed more time in the episode, how about expanding the scene with Nick and Nat? Explain what happened to Denise's body, or just have some nice consolation with the two of them. Was it a budget issue? Was the montage and reuse of clips from previous episodes a way to save money for something coming up? I mean, they better not be out of money already. It's only episode 6, and there's 22 in a season. Now, overall, I did, in fact, like this one. It was a little different. I like the character of Denise. So far, I think she's actually been the best guest star. She wasn't a love interest for Nick, which I appreciate for multiple reasons. The mystery of the week was lame, and not for the first time, the writers seemed to struggle a little bit with how to balance the Nick is a vampire with centuries of memories and experience, and Nick is a police detective storylines, which is a problem, because that's kind of the entire premise of Forever Night. The rundown of Nick's backstory and the music montage makes me wonder if the showrunners or producers or whoever thought they needed to restate the show premise for the audience. I wonder if the show changed time slot or something, why they thought they would need to have those kinds of scenes. But that brings us to the end of things for this week. Next week, we'll be looking at the episode entitled False Witness. And Nick is going to be called to testify in court. Interesting. An examination of truth, responsibility to others. Tune in next time, gentle listeners. In the meantime, are you quivering with existential dread? Wondering when the next episode will release because you don't know how podcatchers work? Or do you just want to waste time looking at unimportant things? Come join me on social media. I'm on Instagram at Still Dreaming Podcast and at Facebook. Look for Still Dreaming, a podcast about existentialism and Forever Night. Thank you very much for paying attention to this pointless rambling. Good night, gentle listener. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.